All right, Mr. Sanford.
It was the court, counsel.
Ryan Sanford on behalf of the appellant Dana Johnson. The issue before the court today is whether a jury is allowed to decide a dispute between private citizens about their alleged violations over and against each other with the government. And we submit that the jury is the proper party for that. It's a False Claims Act retaliation case. Mr. Johnson worked faithfully for Raytheon for over 30 years.
You are going to address our jurisdiction.
Yes, you have jurisdiction.
That's our first, usually our first inquiry.
You have jurisdiction because Mr. Johnson is not disputing anything that the Navy did. We are not disputing any decision by the Navy. We disagree with it. We say it's not right. We say it's based off false information. But we are not, we did not bring a lawsuit against the Navy. We are not saying, Navy, please undo what you did. There is no claim against the Navy. Unlike 90% of the cases that they cite deal with people working for the FBI, another agency that says, hey, agency, you made the wrong decision. We are not doing that. So this court does have jurisdiction. We don't believe that Egan applies to this situation. Egan, again, was someone that was going against government agency for a violation. And they said, look, you can't deal with that if you're trying to overturn a security clearance. In this case, it's a disputed fact whether or not the security clearance was revoked. It was issued by the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is the governing body that makes the predictive judgment based on their discretion, agency discretion, to give somebody a security clearance. And there are actually due process protections with the DOD. There's notice and hearing. If your security clearance is going to be revoked, they notify you. You can appeal it. There's a process.
Your client's with Lockheed now.
Pardon?
Your client is with Lockheed now?
With Lockheed, with a security clearance.
I guess I have two principal questions. One's legal and one's factual. When you say 90% of the cases, let's talk about that other 10%. Do you dispute that the Egan bar has been extended to private sector contractors of the government?
Not at the circuit.
It's never been done here. So are you claiming that we should interpret Egan to disallow the bar in any case where the employee is the employee of a private sector individual? And if that's your argument, what's your best other circuit authority? It may be what Egan, the context of Egan, but do you have any circuit authority to not extend it?
I don't think I have circuit authority that it should be extended, but I will tell you, the best argument is Rattigan. But again, that was not a private company, right? We have a Ninth Circuit case that deals with Raytheon. It was a private contractor. In that situation, they just said, oh,
the Ninth Circuit says we're hesitant, we're skeptical, but they actually, I don't see a circuit that has yet said we will do it to contractors with the government. Do you agree?
I agree.
Okay, so if Egan applies, then I guess this then gets, and I don't want to simplify your case, but it gets down to the second point you were going to make, which is there a fact dispute? Certainly in the hearing a year ago exactly to today, you both disagreed vehemently, but then the district court's opinion quotes the security officer for this program.
Yes, quoting a report, okay, which we objected to is hearsay, right? So So they say, oh, there's a report that says...
That issue's not up on appeal. So we've got an exhibit that says, yes, revoked. We've got that individual who says revoked.
I have an objection based on hearsay, and I'm saying that it's a disputed fact. I'm also saying it doesn't matter, but...
How does it not matter? Isn't that sort of the heartland of vegan?
Because we're not just... Even if the security clearance was revoked, it doesn't eliminate whether or not there was retaliation before the investigation.
I guess that, I mean, the broad theory there, though, that sort of garbage in, garbage out. The Raytheon, Raytheon presented facts that led to an incorrect ruling.
Right.
But it's a ruling. We can't look at how the Department of Defense investigated it. So even if they lied to the department, it would seem that the eventual factual outcome is revocation of national security clearance. And that's a dischargeable circumstance. We can't
second. It would be dischargeable if that was the but-for reason, right? So, and you, that's disregarding all the retaliation leading up to the termination. So just talking about the termination, but for that decision and his protected activity. So under Bostock, you can have many but-fors as long as it's necessary. So if the termination is for the alleged revocation of security clearance and retaliation for the protected activity, we have a case. It could be both. And there are plenty of jobs that he could have had that didn't require access to that program at Raytheon.
Right, but that gets
and
back
that's
to,
the that's that gets the back
to,
case.
This was a security-related concern that only led to removal from the program. But if it was a full withdrawal of any access to secure information, a determination, do you have any similarly situated person at Raytheon that had the Boeing computer, had all that stuff, that also had their security clearance revoked?
No.
Okay, so that...
But I did have plenty of comparators that did the same thing that he did. It did not have their security clearance revoked.
I know,
they monitor
him, they report him, and when they report him, the government,
yes,
in its black box,
yes,
and I know you dispute this fact,
but
ultimately concludes he can't touch security, national security information, and Raytheon says, well, that's what all our people do.
Right, so, Radigan dealt with the same issue. Only not even a private employer. Another coworker wants to retaliate, turns him into the security, gets revoked, and Radigan says you can still sue if the initial information was made and turned in knowingly false. So, and we make that. I know that the...
I'm sure I'm mistaken, but I thought in Radigan, ultimately, there wasn't a revocation, right?
There was, in my understanding, I don't know if there was, actually.
Well,
that would, but there, but the, but the, I'll have to look at that. But the issue was in Radigan is it didn't matter. It didn't, they had jurisdiction because it doesn't matter revocation or no revocation if the person is making a false report that starts the investigation, you have a claim, there is jurisdiction. That's within an agency. And what we have is a private entity making a false report to a government agency.
So just back on what I think of as the determinative fact question, if there were a fact question, my view is you would prevail. Are you saying the record shows conclusively it wasn't revoked? Are you saying that the record leaves it uncertain? Are you saying it's irrelevant as a matter of law whether revocation occurred? Or are you saying this ties to your 56D argument? You needed discovery to know if it was revoked. Which of those four is your primary argument?
First, it's all of the above.
Okay, well, if it's all of the above, counsel, where do you point to in the record to show conclusively they didn't revoke it?
Because they haven't met their burden of proof. All they have is one hearsay statement. And the proof is a document from the DOD that says it's revoked. zero evidence that that's happened. So, not my burden to prove that it happened, right? They can say it happened, but I don't think that's my burden.
I thought, what's his name? Lynn Sharp at Raytheon,
right?
Ryan Holsler at the government, and the exhibit, NCIS, all say.
Right. But the exhibit is a report by NCIS that it happened. It's just a little statement at the bottom in the middle of a report that it happened. So it's not even clear if they're talking about the clearance to the program or the actual security clearance issued by the DOD, which they don't decide. The DOD decides. There is a document that the DOD says, look, it's revoked. Where is that document? It's not there. It's just a hearsay statement in a report, in a sentence in the bottom of one page. And that's what they rely on. It doesn't even say who said that. Zero. At least admissible evidence. So, and for sure it's a fact issue. Let's go back and let's get the official report from the DOD. Let's go back and find out, did it really happen? When we asked the DOD they didn't come back and say it was revoked.
I thought in the 56D order, I thought that he specifically invited you, if there's any fact that might, Judge Fitzwater did, any fact that might illuminate my jurisdiction, tell me, and you could get that targeted discovery.
Okay, I guess if you're talking about specifically the DOD document, I couldn't get a document that says it still exists or it doesn't exist from the DOD. We asked for it, we just got it back and said, here's your status, and it didn't say revoked. So, and is that hearsay? I mean, maybe there's a way I can get that judicially noticed in front of the judge. I don't know. But I have plenty of other facts that I could get in front of the judge that I was not allowed to get in front of the judge, right? That go to whether or not any of this happened, whether or not any of the violations happened. So
the fourth argument I suggested to you was, even if this document went unrebutted and established it was revoked, do you have a legal argument that even with revocation, because it's a private employer, that wouldn't matter?
Yes.
It seems to be, they seem to be around the 28J citing, especially the Fourth Circuit's Mallory decision.
So the Mallory doesn't want to follow.
What's that?
Right? Fourth Circuit doesn't want to follow Rattigan. Rattigan says that the security clearance doesn't matter. You can still go against the entity that made a false report that started the investigation that led to whatever it was. Kavanaugh dissents and says, hey, that's a distinction without a difference. I disagree. We do that all the time in interference cases. We do it in perjury cases. In interference cases, the third party that lands the blow of the adverse action, that decision is not ever disputed, even if it's wrong. It is the interference with that leads to that decision of the third party to land the blow. In a perjury case, if the perjury leads to a wrongful conviction or some other judgment, there's no jurisdiction, there's no claim to overturn that, but the perjury charge still goes on. That's what Rattigan is saying, is that you can't make a false statement. That distinction is even sharper when, unlike Rattigan, we have a private entity that's making a false statement to the government. And we've got plenty of, we have refuted and shown that statement after statement after statement made to the Navy was false. Leading up to that first year where they were just behind the scenes suspecting, all of that was false suspicions that they knew was false. In my 56D, I've got about a minute left with the 56D. The other issues on the 56D, I filed a motion to compel. The court basically said, and Raytheon didn't try hard enough on the 56D. 56D simply says, I have to show specific facts that I can't present, specific reasons that I can't present facts essential to justify opposition. Filed a motion to compel. It was granted. They didn't comply with the motion to compel. I'm ready to have sanctions and contempt. They're arguing classified, which we say is a smokescreen. initially they said his weekly reports were classified, then they admit, oh, they're not classified, they're on a classified system. It's like saying, oh, they're in a file room that you can't go in unless you have classified clearance, but you can go in and pull out all the non-classified documents and give them out to us. That took over a year with TUI process I didn't think I needed to make. We're having huge discovery disputes. The judge says, look, why don't we do this at Raytheon's suggestion? Why don't we bifurcate discovery? So back off on all the discovery disputes, and in reliance on this, I say, okay, judge. The judge says, look, Mr. Stanford, look, we'll split this up, and I'm still going to give you a chance to argue all your discovery. If you can't do your discovery, I'll let you then argue it in a 56D. So relying on that, we back off. We say, okay, we'll do the discovery that they let us do, and then we'll make our argument in 56D. We do that, and then they say, well, that's not sufficient. I should have filed a motion to compel again. They're already not complying with the court order. They say I didn't put reasons in there. In the record, here's one of my reasons. Depositions of co-workers would verify that they did the same activity for which Mr. Johnson is accused of being a security violation. That's one of several places I actually say what I need. The 30B6 person won't even answer questions about whether or not they even know that Mr. Johnson made any violations at all. I can't get any of that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sanford. You have reserved your rebuttal time. Mr. Blanchard?
May it please the court, I'm Charles Blanchard for the appellee Raytheon Company. I'd like to start by explaining what exactly the Navy found. The Navy found that despite the fact that Mr. Johnson had denied it in the interview, that on 100 occasions he used a program called Wireshark on a system for which it's not designed. Wireshark is that there's two different servers, one that Wireshark was allowed, and one of which it was not, and he used it 100 times. And it's important that Johnson denied that in his interview, but the Navy found otherwise. And as Mr. Gary Lamont testified in the record, this kind of serious security violation is not common. He could only think of two or three occasions in the past when it occurred, and in every single instance, the person was terminated.
But that's a hotly debated story, right? Because there's no dispute that he worked for your client for 30 years,
right.
And then there's no dispute that he was a whistleblower. At a rather extreme point, the lives of military officers fought on the government. And then, right after that, he's fired. He's monitored first, and then his theory is they send it up through the government, and all of a sudden, Raytheon can turn around and say, you can't look at any of the possibility that we retaliate.
But here, Your Honor, if you look at the Egan Doctrine and how it's been applied, the Egan Doctrine in the Picard decision in the Fourth Circuit, the Hill decision in the 11th Circuit, and in the Wilson decision in the federal district, the courts all have faced a very similar claim. I'm not going to contest the security violation. I'm going to contest what started it because that was based on false statements. And all three of those circuits said, no, once there's been a finding by the government that the allegations are true, you can't argue. We're not going to allow. We don't have subject matter jurisdiction to argue that the initial allegations are false.
Okay, those are those circuits, but we're in the Fifth Circuit, and we have a published decision, Toy, that has said no court has extended the Egan bar beyond just allegations found to be true. It's got to be a national security revocation, and then we emphatically said we declined to do so. So the Fifth Circuit has pretty much closed the door to allegations made by a private employer that the government finds are true. Somehow that means Raytheon's above the law.
I think the Mowry decision.
Mowry's fourth, so let's stick with
right.
Toy.
But he distinguishes Toy, Judge Wynn of the Fourth Circuit, in ways that I think make sense. Toy involved a building access decision. It was not done by trained security professionals. It was really just done by the supervisor. In contrast here, we have a Lynn Sharp, who's a trained security person at Raytheon, who makes the judgment that she's required to make the report. She hands it over to the Navy. Brian Hostler, who's the Navy security officer, makes the judgment that the allegations are so serious they merit a criminal investigation, so he brings in NCIS. Mm-hmm. And then there's a period of a 9-month investigation. And the very kinds of people that Egan is talking about, making predictive judgments for which there is no judicial review and only is left to the executive branch, is exactly what occurred here.
No, but I read Egan very differently. I mean, that's 30 years ago, and the Supreme Court is pretty much creating a separation of powers argument, saying, MSPB, your judges and your board members, you work for the president. You can't second-guess Article II president's security decision. Somehow, then, later at the circuit level, the ship jumped, and it suddenly becomes Article III courts. You can't look either. I think that ship has sailed, right?
Right.
Even in our court.
And even the D.C. Circuit, the Radican, accepts that as well.
Right, but the Supreme Court's never made this leap that benefits the defense industry, 3% of our GDP, tens of thousands of contractors, hundreds of thousands of employees, and all these companies now can hide behind the Egan bar, do what they want to do, give it to the government. If the government agrees with allegations, no one can look.
I think this is a way I would look at this, Your Honor, is this is about who is best positioned to evaluate these kinds of judgments.
Right, but federal courts are good at then evaluating whether or not those are correct or not.
Although that's not what the other circuits have said.
Other circuits, but you agree with me, the Fifth Circuit has never said Egan applies against Article III review? Or you would say, no, we've already
decided. I believe the Perez decision in this circuit was an Article III.
Okay. And would you say the second level, because I think that we have foreclosed that view of Egan, but is there any Fifth Circuit case that has yet said the Egan bar applies to employees of private sector companies?
No, I think the only Egan decisions in this circuit are Toy and Perez.
Okay.
But there are numerous examples, the Boeing decision in the Tenth Circuit. And then there are several district court decisions, like the Alcazi decision in the Eastern District of New York,
mm-hmm.
The Dyncor decision in the District of Massachusetts, and there's a recent decision in South Carolina, all of which deal with the circumstance. And the reason is this. Egan is not an issue preclusion doctrine. It is not an immunity doctrine. You're not immunizing government decision-making. Instead, you're saying that it's a separation of powers decision. We are going to leave to the executive branch unless Congress says otherwise. We're going to leave to the executive branch security determinations such as that here.
As to its employees.
That's not what other circuits, because here, imagine the scenario where the Navy says this guy is a danger.
Yeah.
If you allow it as to, if you allow the courts to now suddenly second guess the Navy decision just because it arises of a private employee, you have exactly the problem you have with executive branch officials. You're still, at that point, the separation of powers issue is still joined. You're still second guessing the executive branch.
So you're saying even if it were garbage in, even if Raytheon wanted to retaliate, as long as the government itself separately has concluded he can't get access, then the discharge decision can't be reviewed. Is that?
I think the Radican. The answer is yes. And the Radican decision offers a good contrast.
Yeah.
The Radican decision, in fact, the FBI had investigated and found that the allegations were false.
Right. And if I remember, did you argue at the hearing in front of Judge Fitzpatrick?
No. I did.
You did, because I think I remember you said, okay, well, that's distinguishable. We accept Radigan if the government absolves the individual.
Right.
Because and what I'm wondering, I think that's pretty much where it is, except I would say, no, the only way the Egan bar extends to a private employer is if the government actually chooses not to revoke a national security clearance. That's the very limited orbit.
Well, I would say we go beyond that.
I know you do.
Because, for example, in this case, the initial decision by the Navy dealt with access to the special access program. Because the Navy doesn't have the authority to take away anyone's security clearance.
But
it does decide who has access to that program. And that is it really about access to classified information, which is what about the Egan Doctrine is about. So even if his security clearance had not been revoked, the fact that there was a security determination about his access to the special access program, I think that's still the Radican exception that would not apply.
If I disagree and I interpret TOI to tell us it's exclusively extended to the private sector when the government's revoked national security clearance, would you still win? Is there no dispute of fact in the record?
I mean, the record is clear that his clearance was revoked in the record. The challenge here, to be very honest, the challenge is to know whether that was because of the adverse findings or whether it was because he had no longer employed. Both would have been grounds. So we don't know the reason for the revocation.
In September of 2015?
Right.
I hadn't thought of that.
I don't think TOI goes as far as to require a security clearance determination, because that was not what was at issue in TOI. And I think, again, Judge Wynn's decision in Mowry, I think, does a good job explaining.
But Mowry is a guy who's working for the CIA.
Right, but I think he's looking at all
the. He had top secret, and then they did the mental evaluation, and they don't give it to him. They refused it. That sounds to me like the functional equivalent of a national security
regulation. Right. But I think what I'm looking at is his discussion of TOI and the other circuits that deal with the scope of the Egan Doctrine. Is it just pure security determinations, or is it a little bit broader? And he says, you know, TOI is there, but TOI is very different. And he also points to two other courts that have dealt with the Department of the Energy's human reliability kind of determinations. He did not determine who gets access to nuclear weapons. And he says, in those cases, it's very akin to a national security determination. It's a predictive judgment. It's by the executive branch, by people who are specialized in it. And in that case, there is, even the doctrine applies, while a TOI where none of those factors occur, and it's really a supervisor making a business of building access decision, it doesn't apply. And here, we're more akin to the human reliability. It's access to classified information. It's by the executive branch, and it's by people who specialize in this. And so while it's, so it's even without a security classification decision, it still fits within the scope of the Egan Doctrine. And if the court were to hold otherwise, I think he would be creating a circuit split.
Does the government ever absolve people, though? Is that actually a limiting principle, your interpretation of Radical?
I understand your question, yeah.
Well, let's say it goes into the government's black box that can't be looked at, and they don't revoke his national security. They just say, we don't want him working on this program. We've got some much lesser concern. It's specific to this program. And then everybody else, assume for the sake of argument, who used the Wireshack and used the Boeing computers, they get put on different projects, but he gets fired. Court still can't look.
I think the Zanelli case in the Ninth Circuit, it makes very clear that if a plaintiff's theory of the case does not question the Navy government determinations, then Egan doesn't apply because you don't have a separation of powers issue. But in this case, if you know, at the district court level and in this briefing, the theory of the case is the Navy got it wrong. They got it wrong because Raytheon lied, but the theory of the case is still that the Navy got it wrong. And there's no evidence in the record to support this idea that the monitoring here that led to the report to the Navy was any different than what was done on anyone else. Because even Mr. Johnson—
Did they report anybody else that had a bone?
There are, reports of security violations are not uncommon. But
anybody else on the ACT program that had a Boeing computer?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I think a fair inference in the record is the only guy that gets reported is the guy who was the whistleblower.
Although you have the decision maker here, Lynn Sharp, who testifies, as does the decision maker, Gary Lamont, at the termination stage, that they had no idea about the alleged protected activity. And there's no evidence.
Let's say essentially these facts. Raytheon's got a bunch of employees on this highly, very important program, ASAP. And then new person, Lynn Sharp, comes in. She sees a bunch of them are using Boeing computers. And they monitor them. They confirm it. They report it to the government. And the government says, we're not going to investigate further. But discharged, Johnson says. Courts can investigate. We have a ruling.
At that stage, do you have a record where you can accept the Navy findings?
The Navy declines to investigate, still court review of the discharge.
But that's not the record.
I know it's not. But then let's say, I just want to know what your limiting principle is. Let's say the Navy decides to investigate and they say, we've got concerns, we prefer you not having him work on this program, but we're not revoking any security clearance. You think the Egan bar means if they still fire him?
It goes to the reason for the firing. If, for example, the only program for which he was qualified is this program, then you have a legitimate basis. But there still has to be, a non-pretextual basis for firing. And so it really depends on the facts.
Yeah. But here you say first the facts did lead to a revocation, and even if they didn't, other circuit law says that any security-related determination is sufficient to
yes.
handle the company.
Yeah, the human reliability decisions that are discussed. Again, I think Toy is very different because in Toy, it really had none of the indicia that you see in national security determinations. But there's a whole host, and Mallory itself didn't involve a national security clearance determination. It itself was something different.
But
it was predictive, it was by the executive branch, and it was done by people who were experts.
I've asked a lot of questions, you've answered very helpfully, but please, sometimes.
Yeah, I think it might now be useful to sort of turn to the merits in case you don't like what I'm saying.
It's been very helpful.
But I think the important thing here is even if Egan doesn't apply, on the facts of the case that we have here, we still prevail, and that's because the two key decision makers here are adamant that they had no evidence, no reason to believe, and no knowledge at that time they made the decision of any retaliatory action. Looking first at the termination decision done by Gary Lamont, he's as adamant in his deposition, his declaration, he had no idea that there was any allegations. In fact, he went so far as to check the ethics log to make sure there were no whistleblower allegations, and he found none there. Now, Mr. Johnson's counsel puts a big emphasis on the fact that he talked to people in the HR department, but we know what the HR department told him. It's in a report. The report has no mention of any protected activity. And he then talks about how Sarah Mumphrey talked to a lot of these other folks, but he never once even asked Raytheon to depose Sarah Murphy. So we have no evidence in the record other than that the decision maker for termination had no knowledge of the alleged protected activity. The activity, by the way, occurred years before in most instances. And second, on the monitoring issue, there's no evidence on the record that the monitoring here was any different than was done by other folks. He talks about how other people also used Wireshark, but we need to be careful. Remember, Wireshark is allowed in what's called the PL1 server. It's just not allowed under the PL2. And he offers no evidence that people use the Wireshark in the PL2. But the concerns about Mr. Johnson went beyond Wireshark. Lynn Sharp, in her declaration, talks about other matters that were concerning, such as the fact that he asked for a dual computer that could use both Linux and Windows, which was create some security violations. So she mentioned several others as well. So even if Egan didn't apply, this is a very weak case for retaliation, and there's really no evidence. And finally, I'll just make a few observations on the Rule 56D. It was Rule 56D, as you know, is an abuse of discretion. Here, the judge gave Mr. Johnson's counsel two chances to get it right, to offer specific reasons about why the evidence was necessary. And he didn't do so. More importantly, if you look at the long list of 21 depositions, about half of them are people that he's asking in the Rule 56D for the first time. He didn't even ask Raytheon for those depositions. And for others, he had asked, and our response was, explain how this is relevant to the summary judgment motion and we may consider. And he never got back to us. And so in addition to the reasons the judge gave for the Rule 56 decision, which is eminently reasonable, he just simply failed to pursue the discovery. Judge, look, you have a question.
No, I guess I'd loop back if you finished. Was the hearsay objection to the NCIS document urged, and do you recall what the district
court? Yeah, I don't recall that it was. It may have been said in oral argument, but I don't recall.
Do you recall whether or not there was the argument about an inference that could be drawn from Johnson saying he never was notified and he had no opportunity, that always attaches to a security clearance revocation?
Yeah, I mean, he did argue that he never had a chance to contest the security violation, but I can't recall that it was made specific to the, you know, the lack of notice.
Thank you.
Loop back to, you know, counsel's argument up about the 56 days. He's pressing hard at those fact issues. You know, about 56D, you said he didn't. He had two shots at it, but he pressed hard to persuade us that there are fact issues below, et cetera. So would you just respond to that before he comes back up?
This was an extraordinary kind of method. Before we even stuff, because discovery of this period, discovery had been going on for about 2 years. And so this was not the only discovery, and he chose not to depose anyone during that period. During this period, the judge required us to write a detailed, you know, posting of what we were going to argue before discovery. So he had a roadmap as to what we were going to argue. So if he wanted Sarah Humphrey's deposition, he should have asked for it. This was not an opportunity to sort of get an extension of the discovery period in a Rule 56D motion, which is really what he's asking for.
All right, thank you.
So I asked for something like 21 depositions. Inadvertently left off one person, Ms. Humphreys. I should have put Ms. Humphreys on there. I didn't. I started with a Rule 202 Texas pre-suit deposition to try to get to the bottom of it. They fought that vigorously, saying it was classified. The state court judge said, I'll give you interrogatories, which is not even allowed under the rules. So I got interrogatories, they partially answer that. We then filed a lawsuit, and for the first time, a couple years into the lawsuit, do we even get the report to find out what he supposedly did, right? So he didn't even know what his violations were until we get there. I filed a motion to compel. It's granted in toto. 55 things that they're supposed to answer, including personnel files of comparators. Don't get them. Weeklies, going back 7 years. After a fight for a couple years, I get almost a year's worth after they said that. Several other things I don't get, and it's an order from the court. I'm moving forward. The judge says, okay, based on their back off, let's just do this bifurcated cement thing. I am arguing, I'm telling them orally why I want this. They're arguing because I didn't respond to one last email giving them reasons after I've had heated conversations with them over the phone repeatedly why I need all this. And then we take these depositions and basic questions. Does Raytheon have possession of data that can show who downloaded the software? Corporate representative, do not answer that question. I mean, it's very simple to find out who downloaded any software, or supposedly he downloaded illegal software. Any person with basic IT can go in and look at the files and see, oh, who downloaded it. They will not answer that question. Does Raytheon have any facts to dispute Johnson's position that he did not introduce the software? Do not answer that question. Whether Ms. Sharp, corporate representative or individual, actually looked to see who downloaded LockSharp? Do not answer that question. Over and over, I laid all this out, including reasons such as depositions of co-workers would verify that the same activity for which Mr. Johnson is accused of engaged in, for which he's being accused. I have two or three other explanations.
Just while I know you probably want to address, I just want to get the flavor of what you're saying. The district court has three different memorandum opinions here, I mean, this thing is stretching out over a pretty, you know, broad period of time on the discovery stuff. It's abuse of discretion, et cetera. So I think we got where you are. So if you want to shift to some of the other
matters. Yes. Okay. So let me go back to, let's go to the Egan issue. Radigan, the outcome is different. It's internal. The jury's, the court, the D.C. court said a jury is just as competent to determine whether someone intentionally reported something false information as an agency.
Right, but and that, you said standing up that you thought Radigan led to a revocation, and now the correction is
that the correction, if it didn't lead to, what I'm saying is
a critical fact. When the government doesn't trigger the Egan bar, courts will look at what the employer's explanations are. But when the government independently has found stuff that means no national security clearance.
And so what we're saying is, so setting aside that there's no due process in that decision-making process, so issue preclusion, whatever, but setting aside that.
Yeah, but you've got to set that aside because the Supreme Court already did set that.
Right, they said exactly. And they said, hey, there's no right to a security clearance. There is a right for every person not to be retaliated against by their employer. So where does those meet, right? If we go back and we have a trial and the jury says, yes, they made false statements. Yes, when they said you can't talk to the Navy, that's retaliation. When we started making a book on you, false, every one of those things are false. Other people were doing it. You know that's false. And the jury said, yeah, that's false. When you turned over false information to the Navy, on which they base their conclusion, yes, that's retaliation. When it comes back and you do your own sham investigation, independent from the Navy, and you know that it's all false, or there's indirect evidence, or let me go do the discovery to show it, and the jury comes back and says, oh yes, Raytheon retaliated against. That jury verdict is not going to change security clearance at all. Nothing. We're not contesting that at all.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sanford and Mr. Blanchard, for your briefing and your argument in the case. We'll take the case under submission. The fourth case, before we take it up, we're going to take about a 5-minute break, but 21-60829, Pollard v. Campbell.